Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the No Silicast podcast, hosted over at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever-so-slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, December 21st, 2008, and this is show number 183. Well, you're all ready for the holidays? I'm not. Still running around like crazy. We got a party at 4 o'clock today, so I'm actually recording really early. I'm recording around 2:30. I think I promised 2 o'clock. But hey, what the heck? There's always time for tech.
Dumb.
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 Dumb questions.
Dumb questions. Dumb questions.
Dumb one. What is?
How come I always have to?
It's time for Dumb Question Corner.
Well, we're really kicking into a quick starting off with dumb questions. That's because Peter wrote in with a really good one. Here's what he wrote. Why are there DVD minus R discs and DVD plus R discs? Same for CDs, I guess. What to choose and does it make a difference if it's for writing for use on a PC or Mac? Very curious. Greetings from cold Belgium, but not so close as Ireland, I guess. Peter. We've been getting quite a few Belgian listeners, too. It's getting really exciting here. But anyway, to the tech question. The DVD minus R and DVD plus R format difference is one of those really annoying non-standards that seems to be designed purely to make us go nuts. I can't think of any other reason you would do this. DVD minus R came out first, and it was even there 5 years before some knuckleheads thought it needed to be improved, and they came out with DVD plus R. Well, DVD plus R actually does have slightly less storage capacity, but it has better error handling than DVD minus R, which in theory would create fewer coasters when you're burning your DVDs. The bad news is there are two formats. The good news is that a few years back, the manufacturers just started delivering to us DVD plus minus burners, so we can burn either one. DVD plus R would be more likely to create a good disc, but DVD minus R will be more likely to work if you're sending it to someone who may have an older DVD player. Now, the next question I can hear you asking would be, how do I tell if my burner can burn both types? Well, I don't know how to do this on Windows, unfortunately, but I did figure out how to do this really easily on the Mac. There's a great tool I've talked about before called Mac Tracker. It's been around for forever. I mean, I think I've been using it at least a decade. And they recently came out with a web-based version of their tool. It's formatted for the iPhone, which actually means it's really cool to view on a web browser that's on a computer, too. So the site is in Canada, and it's iphone.mactracker.ca. So first, on the left-hand column, you're going to find the families of computers in the list. They go all the way back to the very first 128K Mac. Sorry, no Apple IIs. And they include up-to-the-minute info on modern computers as well. They even have iPods, iPhones. They have the operating systems listed in there now, too. So you find your computer family. So let's say in my case, I would click on MacBook Pro. The next screen narrows down the models. So I would click on MacBook Pro 15-inch late 2008. See how it's working? You start with the grouping, like are you using a Mac Mini or a Mac Plus or a MacBook Pro? What are you using? And then you narrow down exactly what model you have. The final screen then gives all of the gory details of the Mac and when it was introduced. They explain the processor family, speed, system bus, hard drive, original OS, Max, RAM. The list just goes on and on what you can learn about it. This is a great tool also to figure out what kind of RAM to buy or how much you can put in or any kind of doing research on the history of your machines. But back to the dumb question at hand. One of the fields says media, and in there it shows you what kind of media you can burn. Mine, for example, says 8X slot loading super drive, and then in parentheses it says DVD plus minus R space DL. Then it says DVD plus minus RW slash CDRW. Well, I just figured out from that I can burn dual layer discs. I didn't know that. I'm guessing that's what the DL stands for after the DVD plus minus R. And I also know that I can do plus and minus DVDs. Now that I've learned about the better error correction on plus R's, if I'm burning just for myself, say as an archive, I think I'll go with plus R's. For DVD sending to family and friends, I think I'll stick with DVD minus R. I hope this erases some of the mystery for you, Peter, but you're perfectly justified in being confused. Just thank your lucky stars that the HD DVD wars are over and they actually picked one format on that one. By the way, if you find Mac Tracker as useful as I do, stop by their regular site at MacTracker.ca and make a donation. I give them some bucks every few years because I've been enjoying their product for a decade now, like I said. You can download the application or your computer too there, and it's free. Hey, I just noticed when I was in there, they have a version for XP and Vista too. So if you're stuck in work on Windows and you want to do some research, you'll still have it at your fingertips. Well, have you tried ScreenSteps yet? If not, why the heck not? I've been telling you about it for weeks and weeks. Well, let me ask you a couple of questions. Don't you find yourself helping other people learn how to use some computer tool, learn how to use find things on a website, or even just where to click on a screen to achieve something they're trying to do? Well, ScreenSteps is the spectacular documentation tool that takes all of the work out of formatting your lessons and makes it a dream to create professional-looking manuals. Even if you're doing little tiny efforts, it's still really, really useful. I love to use ScreenSteps. I don't seem to go more than like a day or two without finding some excuse to launch it. I've been telling you about their newest revision recently and how they've made some big improvements to their ScreenSteps Live service, which is where you can collaborate online if you're creating lessons and manuals, say, with a team of people, or if you just want to host your lessons and manuals online, even if you're working alone. They've made it now so you can skin your manuals on their site so they look just like your website. I think that's really cool because it bothers me when you feel like you've been directed away from somebody's website. Now, they've always had manuals, which is how you organize your lessons. But what if you don't have an organizational plan yet and you just want to throw a bunch of lessons up? Well, now you can throw them into buckets, which gives you much more freedom to just kind of mess around till you get a good plan together. Maybe you want to make buckets by topic, something like that, where you don't actually have a manual yet. There's so much versatility available to you at ScreenSteps Live over at ScreenStepsLive.com. While you're listening to the show, why don't you just head over to ScreenSteps.com and download the free trial of ScreenSteps. And when you can't resist buying it any longer, be sure to enter the coupon code NOSILLA, that's my name spelled backwards, all capital letters, to get 25% off. Well, I don't know what happened this week, but the boys got inspired. I received 4 audio recordings in 1 week. Let's dig in and hear what they have to say. First up, David Sparks from MaxSparky.com joins us with a review of the Richard Solo 1800 from RichardSolo.com.
Hey, Allison. David Sparks here from MaxSparky.com. To be honest, I've never been much for iPhone accessories. I don't keep my iPhone in a case, and except for an upgraded set of headphones, I've skipped over most of the accessory madness. However, my regular visits from the low battery dialogue forced me to reconsider this minimalism. Specifically, I routinely need more power, which sounds kind of funny coming from a guy named Sparks. This is what led me to the Richard Solo 1800 iPhone battery backup. The Richard Solo 1800, on first glance, looks a lot like a slightly smaller iPhone. It has a similar design aesthetic and shape to the first generation iPhone. It's slightly slimmer and slightly shorter. It's also much lighter than your iPhone. Regardless, it fits in my pocket nicely and is very easy to carry around in my bag. Sticking out the end of the Richard Solo 1800 is the standard iPhone iPod connector port. Once charged, you simply plug it into your device and the Richard Solo starts charging it. There are several charging batteries that require you to plug in the iPhone through a separate iPod cable. I hate having to bring extra cables, and this built-in solution is much better. The built-in connector on the Richard Solo 1800 is firm and actually locks onto your device, requiring you to squeeze it to unhook. This is similar to those older iPod cables. It also includes 2 plastic connectors that lend a little more support to your phone while it is charging. In a pinch, you can use your iPhone while it's charging, but it does feel a little bit funny talking into it with a battery hanging off the bottom. On the other hand, I found holding it with the battery convenient while watching a movie, because the battery plugs in from the bottom instead of the wraparound design of some of its competitors. The Richard Solo can charge just about any iPod with a standard connector. I used it successfully on a first generation Nano, third generation 30-gig iPod, and an iPod Touch in addition to my iPhone. With 1800 milliamps, you can recharge your iPhone and then some. I usually plug it in when my iPhone gets down to 10%, and in about 80 or 90 minutes, it's fully charged again. Charging the Richard Solo simply requires you to plug it in through the mini USB connector to your computer or any USB charging device. Speaking of which, the Richard Solo 1800 includes a wall and automobile USB charger, along with the required cables. I thought this was a great touch, allowing me to recharge from just about anywhere. You can also charge the Richard Solo and iPhone together simply by leaving them connected while you USB recharge the Richard Solo. Charging the Richard Solo 1800 from my MacBook Pro takes about 5 hours. I find the Richard Solo 1800 perfect for busy phone days and travel days. If I know I will be stuck on a plane or relying on my phone and away from extra power, the Richard Solo is a champ. Also, once in a while, I will mistakenly leave the iPod running on my iPhone and suddenly find I've drained my battery. The other nice thing about having this device in my bag is that it pretty much shuts up that inner voice that tells me I'm not allowed to watch long movies, play games, or otherwise carelessly use up my battery. I don't care anymore. I've got a spare tire. I don't need the Richard Solo every day, but when I do, it does the job. As an added bonus, the Richard Solo 1800 has an included LED flashlight and laser pointer. While these extras may seem like window dressing, I actually find them quite useful. I most often need the Richard Solo 1800 when I'm on the road. I often give presentations when I'm on the road, so having a flashlight and laser pointer in my pocket can come in quite handy. You can also use the laser pointer to torment cats. They will chase that red dot all day long, and it never gets old. The Richard Solo 1800 is a great solution for anyone needing some extra power for their iPhone. It retails for $69.95, and you can purchase it directly from their website. You can read more of my Mac ramblings and watch my screencast at MacSparky.com. Happy holidays, everyone. May Santa stop by Cupertino on the way to your chimney.
Well, David, that sounds exactly like what I need. Trade shows in particular, where I run out of juice on my iPhone for sure. You know, I went to Demo and All Things Digital and Macworld and the Podcast Expo this year, and I don't think I went to any of those where I had my iPhone last all day. All that Twittering is probably where I run out. I think I'll try to pick up one of these for Macworld because I'm really going to need it. The price is even right, too. Thanks for the great review, David. Well, let's see. Next up, I got a delightful recording from Doug Ingram of alwaysapples.com.au. I hope you enjoy it as much as I did.
G'day, Alison, from Doug down here in Sydney, Australia. Well, I know that audio submissions to the Nasillacast are usually reviews, but hopefully you'll let this one through. It's an audio message to wish you a Merry Christmas and to thank you for all of the great Nasillacasts this year. And besides, I couldn't let the year go by and have Jane from Perth and Rose from Hobart claim all of the Aussie audio credit. It's also a chance to let you know that there are plenty of male Nasillacast listeners in Australia and that we do know how to make an audio recording. Thanks so much for every episode of the Nasillacast that you've put together for us this year. There's never a dull moment and I always learn something. You have such a listenable style, you obviously do lots of preparation and planning, and your production values are spot on. I always get a chuckle out of chit-chat across the pond, especially when Bart signs off with, "Happy computing!" I was shocked a few weeks back when he actually was happy. It was great this year to finally find out where the heck you got the name for the Nasillacast from. I spent a lot of time on Google trying to find out just what or where or even who a Nasilla was. Then I heard you one day on the Mac Roundtable and you mentioned it there. I think I had to go outside of the Nasillacast to find out what a Nasillacast was. Well, I first came across the Nasillacast from hearing about it on Victor's Typical Mac User podcast, which I in turn heard about from Adam Christensen's MacCast. From one of you, I heard about Ken Ray's macOS Ken podcast, and I now subscribe to his Day 6 show. Why do I mention all of that? Well, it's worth you knowing that the generosity that you all show in contributing to each other's podcasts does come back to you in the way of new listeners like me. Christmas time in Australia coincides with summer, so this is our big holiday and take it easy time of year. I'll be away from internet access for a few weeks from just after Christmas, and I'll miss a few episodes of the Nasillacast, so I wish you a happy new year now. I look forward to more great Nasillacasts next year. All the best, Alison, from Doug in Sydney, Australia. P.S. Did I mention Nasillacast often enough in my message?
Doug, that was the sweetest message. I'm so glad you took the time to make that great recording. And yes, I think you packed in the name of my show as much as is humanly possible in a 2-minute recording. By the way, I actually do have an explanation of the Nasillacast name on the website. On the right-hand sidebar, there's an About Alison, and at the bottom, there's a dedication to Kelly and Eric. If you follow that link in there, there's an explanation of the genesis of the show and the name. It's called Why Is It Called NoSilicast? I really like how you followed the thread of podcasters, too. It's so true that by mentioning other people's shows, you actually gain listeners rather than lose them. Well, I just played your recording in the live show, and Rose and Jane were both there, and they said to wish you a Merry Christmas from more of those people from Australia. Now, this is even more ironic that Doug would call in to show off that we do have Australian male listeners, because I got another male Australian recording this week. It's a tie of 2 for 2 now in the Men versus Women of Australia contest. Come on, women, we need more of you in there. Well, anyway, Scott has a review, and it's a very unusual review. I think you're going to like it. Let's listen in.
G'day, Alison, and all NoSilicast listeners. My name is Scott Rutkowski from Sydney, Australia, and I just wanted to record a software review of a product that I found the other week. Just before I begin my review, I'll just give a few details about myself. I'm actually a blind person and use VoiceOver on the Mac, and I've had a Mac since June this year, and I've also got a MacBook and an iMac, an iPod 4th generation Nano, and an iPod Shuffle. So you can say that I do like Apple products quite a bit there. Now, basically, what inspired me to record this review was that a listener of Alison's wanted to know how to get music from iTunes from an iMac to a laptop or MacBook, I think it was. And I was looking for something myself so I could do the same thing. So I did a Google search and found that there was an excellent product. I've tried a few, like Tune Ranger and some others, but unfortunately they just didn't do the job that I was after. So I did another Google search, searched some forums, and actually came up with a product from a company called SunZia Software. The address is www.sonzea.com. Now, the program is called Syncopation, and it's $24.95 US. What it actually allows you to do, it's a 30-day trial. You can try it for free, and when you decide you like the program, you can buy a license for $24.95 US. So basically what happens is this program allows you to sync your iTunes library on up to 5 different Macintoshes, and basically you can do that. Now, the one license, you use the same license on the 5 Macintoshes if you've got 5 Macintoshes or anything less. And one license will register on up to 5 machines. So that's not too bad for $24.95, quite a good price. So the way this thing works is you install it onto every Mac that you want to sync your music on. Now, the program will also sync podcasts, TV shows, movies, and podcasts, that sort of thing, and your music library as well. Now, I would suggest before you start playing with this application that you read the help file because there are a couple of settings that you do need to change. The major setting is you can have it set up so you have one Mac containing your master iTunes library, and then the other Macintoshes will actually sync with that master library and all the music and podcasts, TV shows, movies, etc. will come across to the Mac using Syncopation. So on your primary Mac, you'd go into Preferences, and under the Sync tab, you would set the radio button to Master Library. Now, when you've done that, you then turn on File Sharing under System Preferences in your Mac. system preferences under sharing. So you'd turn it on for all your Macs. You load up syncopation on all your Macintoshes, and it sort of looks a bit like when you open it up. I'm only going by what I've been told or how the screen's been displayed to me, since I can't see the screen, so I use VoiceOver. You've got your libraries on the left-hand side, similar to your iTunes source list, and on the right you see all your music tracks in your library. So you can sync everything in one hit by subscribing to... on your destination Mac, for example, just say you're using your iMac for the actual master library, you'd go to the destination Mac, which may be a MacBook or whatever, you would join your source Mac, which you'll see in the source view, and once you've done that, you then, on your source machine, would join your destination Mac, which you'll also see in the tree view. And when you click on sync from the other Macintosh, the destination machine, it then gets all its information from iTunes and moves it across to your Mac. Very, very cool. It was a very quick transfer via Ethernet. It took about probably 8 minutes or so for 2.5 gig of music to come across, but it didn't have any trouble. It did it really well. It actually opens iTunes while it actually does the syncing, which is cool. And then they're synced. And whenever you make changes on the master Mac and then load up syncopation again, tell it to sync again, and it syncs the music again. So, very cool. I really like this application, and I think the author should be encouraged to keep developing this program. And I think that future versions will have more features, and I think $24.95 for up to 5 Macintoshes is a great thing. So just wanted to talk about it here. The website again for those who want to try the program out, www.sonzea.com. Thanks very much, Alison, for broadcasting this review on your podcast, and I hope you and your listeners give this program a try, and I'll be keen to hear from any other people who have tried the program. Thank you very much.
What a great review, Scott. It's really interesting how you're able to explain what this software looks like for those of us with vision. This software definitely sounds like it's going to solve the problems of our listeners that have been having with this. I think it's a great, sounds like a great idea. I put a link in the show notes to Sonzea so you guys can follow it. You know, I'm sure a sucker for an Australian accent too. I just love all these great Australian recordings. Keep them coming. Now, of course, Rose and Jane are still listening here, so now I threw the gauntlet down and said we got to see if they can find more women Australian listeners to call in. So that's the challenge to the audience. Well, next up, we've got a great recording from Robert Lockman of PhotographyInTheMac.com. You may remember him as the man who stormed my house, actually stalked me as a podcaster so that I would wax his car for him a few weeks ago. Actually, he's a very cool guy. He's not from Australia, but luckily he's got great content.
Hi, Allison. This is Robert Locke from PhotographyAndTheMac.com. Before I get to my main topic, I wanted to let you know I tried using PBWiki after listening to you and Bart talk about it on your last show. This seemed perfect for me. Another way to get organized, you know, be more efficient instead of actually just getting the work done. I've heard of Wikipedia, but never PBWiki. But you guys made it sound great. I was going to have my own personal wiki that I could share with others. How about that? Web 2.0. You and Bart made it sound perfect. You have a document up on the cloud. What could be better? Although, really, it's on some giant computer out in the middle of nowhere, but it sounds a lot better when it's up on a cloud. Okay, back to the PBWiki software. It seemed like it would be perfect. I would make a Photography in the Mac wiki, and I would use it for various reasons. Share it with other people. Get my workflow really going great. It all sounded good. My main plan was to share show notes with Tim Proporton of the Mac Review Cast when we would do a segment together. I was also going to do another one with my wife. That way, I could share some documents with her. It would be perfect. Until one snafu. I tried to assign people to different folders I made. and it didn't seem to work. I went to the tutorials, I looked at it, and their tutorials worked. You could assign security to move people around to different folders. Not the case. So I sent an email to PBWiki support. I did get an answer from one of the support gurus, and they said, custom security for pages and folders is a premium feature. You would need to upgrade to use these tools. Well, how much is it to upgrade? $99 a year. It's pretty expensive to write a few wikis. So I'm going back to the old system. I guess I'll just go old school. You know, email. It's kind of funny. Email is now getting to be old school. Now it's time for my selections of the best photography books of 2008. This year it was simple to pick out number one because one photographer's book stood out and simply was a cut above the rest. Number one for me was Joe McNally's The Moment It Clicks, Photography Secrets from One of the World's Top Shooters. The description is accurate. McNally, whose work has appeared in publications like Sports Illustrated, National Geographic, and Time Magazine, is one of the best shooters around. His enthusiasm and teaching ability jump right off the pages. It's a combination of his witty sayings and his constructive photo tips explaining how he makes each of the photographs that make the book work. The book, The Moment It Clicks, is part coffee table book with beautiful photographs and part how-to book with McNally as the lighting specialist. Everything is there for you. Interacting with the subjects, available and strobe lighting, camera angles, and putting your subject in the proper location. Some of the chapters include getting the right 5 minutes, try something different, have faith in your ideas, shoot what you love, zoom with your feet, try something different. It's really all about Joe McNally, the problem solver. He throws in many of his sayings along the way. Some rules are good ones, like the rule of thirds. It works, but like all rules, you gotta break them once in a while. When shooting a story or someone, the hands should always be on the list. Nally's book, The Moment It Clicks, Photography Secrets from One of the Great Shooters, gets my highest recommendation. Okay, here are a few more nice books I found on the shelves of Barnes & Noble. Other books out this year you might want to take a look at are Digital Portrait Photography, Art, Business, and Style by Steve Sent, Michael Friedman's Top Digital Photography Tips, or you might want to try Face to Face by Rick Salmon. For those looking for a beginning book in digital photography, you might want to try The Digital Photography Book, Volume 2 by Scott Kelby. This is an inexpensive book, which is probably one of the best photography books for the amateur out there. Scott uses a very simple approach in the book, and it's not full of long-winded explanations or it's not real complicated. He just basically has one nice item per page. You can just jump right in and start reading. It's very simple. One last book I'd like to recommend is the Photoshop Elements 6 book for digital photographers. This book is by Scott Kelby and Matt Kleskowski. This book is perfect for those of you who have Photoshop Elements and want to learn more. It's an easy way to really progress and make your images look a lot better. Allison, I hope this helps. If anyone would like to check out my website, it's photographyandthemac.com. This week, I've got some great photo tips for improving your holiday photographs, a software review, more of my cell phone photos, and some photos I shot of a certain Nozillacast host with my Lomo camera that takes 8 photos in 2 seconds. So check it out. It's photographyandthemac.com. Have a nice week, Allison. I'll talk to you later.
Hey, Robert, that was great. I really love your book reviews. I don't understand how you can be such a capable, professional photographer and yet not look snootily down your nose at us amateurs. You review books for amateurs, you show us how to do things in Photoshop Elements on Tim's Mac ReviewCast, and never once do I get the snooty, oh, you don't have real Photoshop sound from you. When people get all high and mighty like that, they become incompetent teachers. I can learn from you because you don't put people down. Hey, maybe you should start a dumb question corner on your site for these for photography questions. You know, the ones we all feel too dumb to ask, but probably somebody else has the same question. You know, like, what's up with ISO anyway? I also love Scott Kelby's book on Photoshop Elements. I read the one he wrote on Photoshop Elements 4 cover to cover, and then I bought his book on 6 too. His style is funny and engaging, and he uses great examples. I even posted a little tutorial on my site on how to remove wrinkles in photographs, and I learned how to do that from his book. All right, now back to your questions about PB Wiki. I think for your needs, there's another method to reach your goal of nirvana in organization. All you have to do is create two wikis, one for you and Tim for your show notes, and the other for you and your wife to organize your lives. That's what I did, and it works perfectly. I have one shared with a bunch of my friends for party planning, and another one that I share with Bart for our show notes. Easy peasy, as Niraj would say. Let me know if that works for you. Well, a little while after I wrote back to Robert about this, we talked offline about his PB Wiki woes, and he told me of another issue he had. One of the great things about a wiki is that if you're watching a particular page or wiki, it'll send you an email when the page has been updated. That way you don't have to keep going over to see if anything is new. The problem Robert had, though, was that he likes to save a lot. I am exactly the same way. That Command S is right there. Save, 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 save. Do it all the time, all day long. Saving, 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 because I don't want to lose anything. But the problem was, every time he saved, it sent emails to Tim and his wife. He sent like 10 in 15 minutes. It was driving them crazy. Well, I explained to Robert that in other wikis I've used, like Confluence and MediaWiki, there's a button that says, "This is a minor edit." You can click that before you save so you don't send an email to the people. Just if you fixed a typo or just a little tiny bit, you don't want to send an email. I looked for such a button on PB Wiki and I couldn't find it. It turns out while I was looking for it, I'd made a slight edit to a page while I was doing that poking around, and suddenly I noticed a little notice down in the right-hand corner of the save or cancel button, right next to the save or cancel button. It said, "Save 231 words at 2:08 p.m. less than a minute ago." What turns out, PB Wiki is auto-saving for you all the time anyway, so you don't have to hit the real save until you're completely finished. I think this is even better than the "This is a minor edit" button, because it removes two clicks for you, save and that button. PB Wiki for the win! Well, to the rest of you listening, after you're done perusing Robert's great website at photographyinthemac.com, sign up to follow him on Twitter at twitter.com/photoandmac. He's a lot of fun to follow because he posts links to photos he's taken. Well, for Christmas this year, I want to suggest you give yourself a present. Give yourself the gift of Honda Bob's mobile service. Give yourself the gift of relaxing at home or being productive at work instead of sitting in some smelly mechanic shop while someone you don't even trust works on your Honda or Acura. Imagine the peace of mind you could have with a mechanic you know will do a great job, will be honest and hardworking on your behalf. Can you even imagine that? Imagine improving the resale value of your car because you let him do regular service on it. You can have all of this at an affordable price by calling Honda Bob at 562-531-2321 or shooting him an email over at hdabob@aol.com. I wish Honda Bob could travel worldwide, but this Christmas idea is only available to those of you lucky enough to live in the LA or Orange County areas. HA Bob's mobile service is not affiliated with Honda, Acura, or Honda Worldwide. Well, it's that time again. It's time for Chit Chat Across the Pond with Bart Bouchatz from BartB.ie. How's tricks out in Ireland there, Bart?
It's a combination of good and bad. I had a good week, but I think the excessive party season has gotten the better of me. I've come down with a bit of a cold.
You know, it was a little rugged getting up to go for my run this morning, I got to tell you. 41 degrees in Los Angeles is a little bit nippy.
What's that in real money?
Let's see. It's 10 degrees above freezing, which is, pretty cold.
10 Fahrenheit degrees, though, so.
Right. Those are the big degrees, right? Let's see. That's
five. Are little degrees.
Oh, okay. 5.5.
That's cold.
In C. Yeah, that was cold for me. I wore my Dartmouth sweatshirt, though, so it kept me warm. But it was tough getting out of bed and knowing it was that cold and after staying up pretty late last night, so.
Oh, dear.
Well, I think some other people had a worse end of the week here. Bart, what are we going to talk about here today?
Well, actually, they had a grand end of the week, but there's been a lot of... let's just say Microsoft haven't had a good run of things security-wise in December. We got through the year with... We had one potential worm incident, which they got patched quick enough to prevent the worst of the worst happening. But then, you know, we all thought that was the worst security incident of the year. But Microsoft outdid themselves yet again with our lovely friend Internet Explorer being the root of the issue. Basically, I mean, I've sort of thought about this one as being as much about the actual vulnerability as an excuse for us to talk about some of the different jargon that you tend to hear out there when you talk about these things. So I'm just going to talk about it. Whenever I use some jargon, and you have to stop me.
I think that's a great idea, because a lot of the stuff people don't learn about security because the terminology is kind of freaky and weird. And, you know, a lot of people like to make themselves sound smart by making it big, fancy words that nobody understands. But that's not what you want to do, right?
Exactly. I mean, I had to word up the emails to go out to our staff this week because it was so bad. We sent out emails to all staff saying, don't use Internet Explorer because.
Yikes.
And so I had to word up those emails. And then we had to send out another one saying, oh, Microsoft patched, so make sure you're up to date. And then you can, if you want, use Internet Explorer. Not that we said, oh, everyone go use IE. Because I have to say I took great pleasure in officially recommending Firefox.
No, we don't want to gloat here, though, Bart, because we're not in gloat mode, right?
No, absolutely not. Right, this can happen to any operating system. You know, anything that uses the Internet is vulnerable to this kind of carry-on.
Right. You know. Well, we're probably getting ahead of ourselves. So what actually happened this week? What was the sequence of events?
Okay, well, it wasn't this week. It started off the week before this week. Microsoft, in order to make things easier on big business, which, let's face it, is, as much as Apple is targeted at the home user, Windows and Microsoft is targeted at the enterprise. I mean, that's what makes their head move. And the fact that people use it at home is almost secondary. So they don't release updates when they're ready. They release updates on the second Tuesday of every month, which is called Patch Tuesday by most people.
Right, because it was driving us crazy before that, when it'd be every 15 minutes you get a little one here and there.
Well, it was mainly driving sysadmins and stuff in large corporations crazy, because they would want to test before they pushed an update out.
Right.
So at least they know to keep every Tuesday free. Sorry, the second Tuesday of every month free. And what happens, in fact, on the first Tuesday of every month is they issue an announcement to say where the patches are. So they don't give you any detail. They just simply say, next Tuesday's bulletin will contain 5 fixes. 4 of them are rated critical. 3 of them are rated serious. 1 of them is rated whatever. 2 of them are in Windows. 2 of them are in Office. 1 of them is in Media Player. I mean, whatever. They just give you those kind of very vague details.
Just so that they can get prepared and have an idea of how much work they have the following week?
Mostly. So basically, they know how bad it is, how urgent it is. I mean, if there's nothing labeled critical, they may simply decide, we're too busy this week, we're going to leave it for a week. Or if it's labeled critical, they really, really know it's vitally important, could cause serious damage, we really have to keep Tuesday free for this. So it gives business the ability to plan. Corporate IT love it. And that's why it came into being. Okay. So a little side effect of Patch Tuesday is that the bad guys also obviously know exactly when Microsoft are going to release stuff. So the first, if they have an exploit, they don't use it until the day after Patch Tuesday, so that they get a full month before Microsoft patch it.
Oh, I see. If it's a vulnerability that hasn't been patched, you mean?
Yeah, if they have found something, it's called a zero day. So if they have found something nasty, and we'll talk about the definition of zero day in a sec, but if they find something, they hold on to it. They don't immediately show their cards. They will hold on to it until a Patch Tuesday comes around, and then on the Wednesday, they let rip.
I see. All right.
And that's exactly what happened this time.
Okay.
So we should possibly explain zero day, because it's a word that's often abused nowadays. But what a real zero day, what it means is that the first time anyone in the security industry is aware of the existence of the problem is when it's being used for real in a genuine attack.
Okay, that makes sense.
Some people, I hate it when security researchers call something a zero day vulnerability, when what they mean is, I found that Microsoft didn't. But none of the bad guys have it. It's not actually being used. But if I use the word zero day, it sounds better.
So it's a
horribly abused word.
In general, what happens is a normal exploit would be that Microsoft patches it, and a couple of days later, people start exploiting that hole.
Yeah.
But it's if it comes out the same day as the patch, or if it comes out before a patch?
Before. It has to come out before a patch.
Oh, okay.
So the first idea the first idea the good guys have that this thing exists is when people are being actually attacked for real.
Oh, okay. Got it. Okay.
So that's what happened in this case.
Okay.
Some people also call them O days, because it's usually written with the number 0 and then dash DAY.
Okay.
And I think that's really silly as well. It's a zero day, not an O day. But I get these, there's two things that annoy me in computery world. It's people who say router in Europe. I know Americans say it router, but in Europe it's a router. And people who call things O days. But anyway,
you know, my father lives. Father-in-law lives in San Diego, and he calls it a router. And I keep the problem is a router is Roto-Rooter is a thing that you drill down in a drain to get the gunk out to get it to clear the drain. So that's what I think of every time he says router. Maybe he's just trying to be cosmopolitan European.
You see, when you say router, I think of this yoke that drills into wood and you use to make a big trench out of wood.
Sure.
So, so we both think of the wrong thing. Anyway, so second Tuesday, patches come out. The next day, a flaw in IE starts to be used for real by the bad guys to actually attack people. And this is not a particularly nice flaw. Basically, the sequence of events would be user goes to web page, user is hacked. That simple.
Okay.
So this is what we call a remote vulnerability. So the bad guy doesn't have to be on your machine.
Oh, I see what you're saying. I get the distinction.
Now, there's remote execution or remote vulnerabilities do get worse than that, because in this case, the user still had to do something. What they had to do was go to a web page that was infected.
Okay.
Or open an email that contained the dodgy HTML.
Right.
But it wasn't entirely automatic. The worst kind is basically what causes worms, is where the bad guy, while not being on your machine, can hack it from a distance.
Hmm. Okay.
Worst kind.
We aren't talking about that today, though.
We didn't have that. We had the second worst kind. So the hacker has to be nowhere physically on your machine, but still they can compromise you.
Okay.
And this is the most common type these days, because everyone does stuff online. So the easiest way to do is to have your hack sitting on a web server somewhere and just trick people into visiting your website, either by hacking a legitimate website they would be going to anyway, or by sending a link and hoping they click on it.
Okay, so that was remote code execution, right? Or remote vulnerability, I should say.
It's a remote vulnerability. And then the other thing it did is arbitrary code execution, as you hear a lot. What that means is the bad guy can run anything he or she wants on your machine.
Okay.
So when you have a remote arbitrary code execution, that's bad.
Why do they call it arbitrary code? It's like it just means anything I feel like. I can be arbitrary about it, not specific.
Well, it means that the vulnerability is very generic. So some vulnerabilities might only allow you to delete files, or some vulnerabilities might only allow you to append something to the end of a file, or might allow you to read stuff out of a database that the bad guy isn't supposed to have access to. Whereas arbitrary code execution means the bad guy has carte blanche.
Okay, so the Trojan horse that was around that we were talking about for DNS, where it would change your DNS settings, that would not be an arbitrary code execution because it was very specific?
Okay, no, Trojans are always arbitrary code execution. A Trojan is a program you run, so a program can do anything.
But I thought it was very specific, though. I thought it went...
It does something specific, but a Trojan can do anything, so it's arbitrary. It's what it can.
So what's an example
if you hack a website, it may only let you read people's credit card numbers. That would not be specific. That would not be generic.
Okay.
But if you hack a server in such a way that you can run any command on the server you like, then it's arbitrary.
Sounds like most of these problems are arbitrary, right? That they go
depends on which hat you're wearing. As a sysadmin, most of what I see is SQL injection and very specific types of vulnerability. Whereas as a home user, pretty much anything anyone wants to attack you with is arbitrary code execution.
Okay. And we won't go down the SQL insertion route. We'll save that for another day. But okay, so I think I got an idea of what arbitrary code execution is. And then remote code execution has to do with the fact that they don't have to be on your system. All right.
Yes. So in this case, what it actually boils down to is you visit a web page and the bad guy has the power to run anything he or she wants on your machine.
Okay, got it.
Which is bad, because it means they can install keyloggers, it means they can install a backdoor to let them log into your machine, it means they can scour your machine for personal data and send it all home, it means they can change your DNS settings so they can hijack all your web traffic. I mean, arbitrary code execution gives them the ability to mess you up in many, many, many ways. It's not good. And to get it just by visiting a website is very, very bad.
Now, do the big corporate firewalls protect you from things like this?
Not reliably.
Okay.
NAT doesn't protect you at all. A proxy doesn't protect you at all. Maybe if they're deploying some very fancy stuff at the border of the corporate network where they're actually looking for known bad URLs, maybe, but you really can't count on your corporate firewall protecting you. There's no real way for it to.
Right, because as people figure this out, there's going to become more bad URLs, right?
Absolutely. It spreads like wildfire across the internet. I mean, well, there is one way you can protect yourself from a corporate firewall. You plug it off the internet.
Plug. Yeah, really.
Yeah. perfect protection.
That might be a little bit of difficulty in business. Okay, so
yeah.
We've got our terminology pretty well defined here. So what happened last week?
Okay, so the first thing that happens is this vulnerability leaks out, and Microsoft admit the very next day on the Wednesday that they're seeing, you know, limited exploitation of this only in IE7 and only on Windows XP Service Pack 3. And it doesn't sound too bad.
Right.
And then a few days later, Microsoft say, this might actually affect more versions of IE. We're not sure. And we're seeing attacks grow. Uh-oh. And then a few days later, Microsoft released another bulletin saying that there's extensive exploitation of this issue, and it affects all versions of IE on all versions of Windows.
All versions of IE? 6, 7, 8,
on all
eight,
versions of
everything?
Windows. Whole kit and caboodle.
Oh my gosh. Can you imagine how bad that day was for the person who's going, you know, they put out the thing going, okay, it's only IE7 on XP Service Pack 3, and then the next day they're going, oh, crap.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just, oh, I feel so bad for those people.
Yeah, and attacks, basically the number of reported attacks is just ballooning constantly. No, yeah. It's only five people. Oh, it's 500. Oh, it's 5,000. No, it's 5 million. No!
Oh, jeez.
It's a bad one. It's a very bad one. And IE is such a heavily used product because a lot of corporate environments don't give you a choice in the matter. You are using IE whether you like it or lump it.
Now, I'm going to insert my own political thoughts here. One of the things I'm a big believer in is diversity. And we talk about diversity all the time about how if you have a diverse workforce, you get better ideas, right? If you've got all different races, creeds, cultures, you know, everybody all mixed together, you're going to get better ideas than if everybody's the same. Well, the same thing, I think, applies in the case of computing. If you force your corporate network to only use IE, or let's even say only Firefox, then you're completely 100% vulnerable. If half the people happen to be using a different browser, you know, I know you have to support two, but you've got diversity. Only half of your network goes down if, you know, if that kind of thing happens. I don't know.
Exactly. It's a good reason to have Macs and Windows and Linux all mixed into your network. Because
well, I think so, too.
On the counter side, if you have too many things, it becomes impossible to support, and then you have a new problem.
Right. I had an idea at one time that what if you took on your corporate network, you had all Windows boxes, but in the case of a massive vulnerability attack, you could reboot those systems and they were dual boot into Linux, where everybody could flip over to Linux and they could still get to the network.
It's
they could
funny
still
you say
email.
That.
Do you do that?
No, but myself and the director were chatting saying, you know, if this gets too bad, you know, it could come to the point where we're standing at the front gate handing out Ubuntu CDs.
Yeah.
And I said, yeah, but then no one will be able to work. And he said, well, think about it. Everyone here uses IMAP, so all their email is in the cloud. Mm-hmm. We tell everyone to save all of their important documents on their network file shares so they can mount those from the Linux CD. So they have their files and they have their email and they can use OpenOffice to edit their documents.
Right.
They can browse the web. So actually, they can do an awful lot of work.
I don't think I would really be that. I don't think I'd be that impaired if I just had to switch OSs, you know, overnight. Because I do keep. In fact, I don't even write stuff in Office anymore. I write everything on a wiki or a blog, because I want to be able to get to it everywhere. And everywhere defines, you know, means if I changed operating systems, I could do it.
Yeah. So we have actually come a long way. But I thought it was interesting. You know, initially I thought he was mad, but then I thought about it and I went, actually, you have a point. So worst comes to the worst, we're just going to be in here all night burning CDs. It didn't come to that, though.
Okay, so now Microsoft has said it's all versions of IE. What did they recommend people do?
They also, in the same announcement, they gave 1 day notice. They never do anything without notice. So they gave 1 day notice that at 1 p.m. on the next day, which was this Wednesday, they would be releasing an out-of-band patch. And that's our last bit of jargon. Out of band means not on Patch Tuesday.
Okay. So it's got to be pretty stinking bad to do that.
Yeah.
I mean,
if you see an out of band patch,
it could be critical and it would still be done in band frequently, right? So,
yeah.
So out of band is worse
mega.
Than critical? Hyper mega.
Yeah. Yeah, they do not release out of band easily. They resist it. They don't like to do it because it annoys corporate IT, and they will only do it when there are widespread attacks happening for real.
Wow.
So it's the second time this year. We had another out of band not too long ago for that wormable vulnerability we talked about quite a while ago. So, you know, an out of band, if you see an out of band coming from Microsoft, do not think, just install.
Oh, jeez.
Yes, it may break your system, but not installing it may get you totally hacked, which is probably worse.
So how many people have been attacked by this? Do you know?
We don't have numbers. Microsoft, I've never seen Microsoft release statements with, there are 5 million people who've been hacked by this. I did hear one number mentioned that this only seems to have affected 1% of IE users. And I thought to myself, 1% of IE users?
That's what, a billion people or something, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know whether that means that it was only 1% were potentially attackable because you need to be configured in a very specific way, or whether that was 1% of people who were attacked. They were really not clear on that. I really, really hope it's the latter. But even if it's 1% of IE users are vulnerable, that's still a massive attack surface. Like, so many people who could be targeted. And then there is one final twist to the tale. So on the Wednesday, the patch does indeed come out at 1 p.m. Pacific, which is very annoying for us here in Ireland because that's 6 p.m.
Yeah, what are you going to do? It's going to be in the middle of the night for somebody, I guess, right?
Yeah, it is, but it means that everyone is still vulnerable the next morning until Windows at 12 noon decides to go do its automatic check.
Oh, yeah.
Now it seems, software update seems to work strangely because people who left their machines on overnight all were asked to reboot first thing in the morning.
Okay.
So even though we've set them to check at noon, they seem to have magically known anyway. I don't know how that works.
Now, I don't... That's interesting. I didn't know any of this had happened. Somehow I was sound asleep over playing with wikis or something. And
not the BBC. Like, not the BBC tech news, the BBC real news.
Well, remember, I don't watch the news either, so...
Well, that'll do it then, yeah.
But you'd think somewhere on a Twitter or something I might have noticed this. But I didn't get a notice to reboot until late Thursday.
Oh.
Yeah, I didn't see anything. And I
didn't. Because on Wednesday, the bad guys found another trick. So remember I was saying, you know, the way you would solve the problem was don't use IE. Use Firefox, because then you won't browse to a web page that's infected. Well, the bad guys found a way to wrap an ActiveX control inside a Word document that would then cause the vulnerability.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, so then it becomes a case of someone sends you a Word document for comment and wham.
Now, isn't there also a way in Firefox that you can do an IE tab inside Firefox?
Yeah, that is actual IE, so that still gets you just as hosed.
Right. So if you've set that up for, there's a certain website that always gets horked if you try to do it in Firefox, if you have that one set to open in...
IE tab, IE. It's called, I think.
Yeah, you'd be screwed there, too.
Yeah, because it is just IE wrapped up inside a Firefox window.
This is huge.
Yes, this is a big one, which is what, I mean, you know, out of band says it all. But it is out, so it's important that if you're a Windows user, that you run software update to make sure you're fully up to date.
You know, I've
manually run it, and it will tell you whether or not you need to download this.
I've got a Windows box. Remember, I bought that HP Mini Note. I haven't plugged that into the network in a while. Maybe I'll run a little update on that sucker today. What do you think?
You should. And the other thing that everyone forgets is if you're running Parallels or VMware or anything like that, boot up those VMs, let them update themselves, and then put them back to sleep.
Oh, holy cow. Yeah, because a lot of times, I mean, I've got a Mac Mini with it on there, and I just don't, you know, I don't boot it up very often.
And, you know, in 5 months from now, when you go to fire up that VM, you're not going to remember not to touch Internet Explorer.
Right. So this could live on for quite some time.
If you think about Blaster, I mean, that's still out there in the background of the Internet. I mean, these things just don't go away. They just stay hanging around. And the bad guys know that people don't patch, so they keep trying at these old vulnerabilities.
Right,
keep having success.
So they can do anything they want in your system, take all your personal data. I assume just the very least of that would be they could make you a bot in their botnet and all that, too.
You'd be lucky if that's all they do, yeah. Very lucky.
That's the good news? Oh, Christ.
Yeah, exactly. The bad news is they start logging every keystroke you make, get all of your passwords, all of your credit card details, all of your banking details. You know, that's as bad as it gets, pretty much. You don't want to go that route.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I know we said in Security Lite was supposed to, you know, be short, but it did have the important aspect here of there is something you can do, there's something you have to do.
So
I think this fit.
Yeah, and we did say that if there was something really serious that happened, and this is the most serious of the year. We thought we'd had a very serious one earlier in the year, but this is the most serious, and I really hope it's the most serious of the year, because if something worse happens between now and New Year, I'm not going to be in work, and God knows what I'll find when I come back.
Oh, yeah. Now, I was just looking at the, there's a site called the United States Computer Emergency Readiness Team, US CERT.
US CERT, yes. And I always advise people to subscribe to the RSS feed.
So the one that I'm, it looks like I found the right one, Microsoft Internet Explorer Data Binding Memory Corruption Vulnerability.
That's the one.
That's the one. Okay, I'll put a link to that in the show notes too.
Yeah, but it, I mean, the volume of traffic on US CERT is very low. Right. And they don't waste your time with, you know, little pernickety things.
Oh, okay.
So if you get, you know, just two or three a week from US CERT, that's a lot. So I would highly recommend anyone who is even remotely computer literate and who cares about security, at the very, very least, subscribe to US CERT. Stick it in your RSS reader and just keep an eye on it. It won't always be stuff you have. I mean, they also mention when there's problems with Cisco stuff, because Cisco was just used so ubiquitously to make the internet go.
Okay.
But you'll also see things like, you know, Apple have released an update. You'll see Microsoft have released an update. And it'll have a link to where there's more information. But if there's something big happening in the world of security, it will be on US CERT.
Well, speaking of which, didn't we just get a another OS X patch, I think, yesterday?
We did.
Or this morning.
Was there another one this morning? The last I saw was 10.5.6, which was earlier in the week.
No, I got one. I got a noticed upgrade today. I don't know what it wants to upgrade, but it wants to upgrade something.
Okay, I have a feeling you're just set to do stuff on Saturdays, because you always have them way later than me.
Well, no, I got 10.5.6, I don't know, 4 or 5 days ago. So this is okay. This is something else. I haven't looked at it yet.
A lot of updates for the Aluminium Max.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Trying to fix things there, so.
Apparently it's for the accuracy of the indicator on the MagSafe and stuff like that.
Oh, okay. Well, that's.
Do you really want that?
Yeah, I would like that to know what's going on. All right, well, we are actually going to probably wrap it up right there. I appreciate you bringing this to our attention. And, you know, the fun is just sucked out of gloating on these kinds of things. You know, I just feel for people. I feel for the sysadmins. I feel for the poor people at Microsoft who, you know, they're doing the best they can and they get something like this. But at least you helped us understand some of the terminology and what to do about it.
Yeah, and, you know, have no doubt this will happen on the Mac someday.
Yep.
Now, if like you say, with this diversity stuff, half of us are on Safari and half of us are on Firefox, at least only half of us will be screwed.
At the same
time. Can I say that?
Right. Yeah, yeah, you're okay. You know, I know I said we were winding up, but I want to do a little bit of a rant here.
Hey, I meant to rant. You're not meant to rant.
No, I've been holding this one back for a while, but I just really got to do it. You know, I worship at the house of Leo. I mean, I listen to as many of his podcasts as possible, and I was just telling my daughter last night that I frequently find myself spouting things that I don't even care about, but Leo does, so I act like I care. You know, I don't even listen to music, but man, I'm pissed off at the RIAA. You know, why should I care? But I can hear myself saying what he says. But the other day, or it was a week or two ago, I was just mad as a hornet when I was listening to him on MacBreak Weekly. And he said, and I wish I had the quote exactly, I should try to get it, but he said, don't you think Mac users are just smarter than Windows users in general, that they won't just, you know, the Windows users like, duh, just go click on anything. I was like, what are you thinking? I don't know, that's like saying a race is smarter than another race to me. I mean, it was so patently absurd. I found it really, really offensive that he would say that. And I think, if anything, we're probably dumber than the Windows users because we haven't had to worry about it. So it's not at the front of our minds. We're much
I wouldn't
more
use
likely,
the word dumber, but more
less
naive.
Informed, sure, sure. But he was saying dumb. He actually was saying dumb, and he was saying, you know.
I know. No, I heard that too. And I remember thinking, Leo, I agree with you a lot. But not with that.
Not today. No, not today.
And that's a dangerous, dangerous thing to say. That is exactly the kind of smug Mac user arrogance that is going to be wiped off everyone's faces at some stage.
Yeah. I also did comment on a posting. I'm trying to remember. Was it on CNET? Where somebody had posted a comment about saying, is Apple going to give them money back or you know, some snotty thing about how, are they going to retract those commercials they did that were totally false. And he was talking about the original Mac PC ad where they were saying they didn't have any viruses. And
they still don't.
Right. They still don't. And what was great was the guy links to that video saying, see, and it's like, no, they didn't actually say anything that wasn't true. And plus, even if there are viruses later, that doesn't make it not true when they sent it out. Right.
Yeah. You can't go back in time. You know, just because you were the cheapest product in 2005 and then someone's cheaper than you in 2006 doesn't make you a liar in 2005.
Exactly. Exactly.
You know, there are no Mac viruses. Even now, there are Mac Trojans, but that is not the same thing.
Right. But it does make us realize that we've got to be paying attention here. And I think it's good that you bring it up to us and, you know, just keep it in the back of our minds that, you know, don't be clicking on links and emails that you don't hover over first and find out where they actually go.
Yeah, because remember, you have the power to do anything on your machine, including delete all your own stuff. So any program you run has exactly the same power that you have.
Yikes. So what's your mantra that we've got to have there, Bart?
Ever-present vigilance, which I stole from Mad-Eye Moody.
But I think it's very applicable here.
By the way, I just ran software update. The only thing I'm getting new is a digital camera RAW compatibility update.
Oh, I get those all the time, and I don't even use RAW, so...
Yeah, but if you ever buy one of these new cameras, let me see, it's the 5D Mark II, the new PowerShot G10, I didn't know there was a company called Leaf. They apparently make cameras and loads of them.
Huh.
And a Leica M8.2, whatever that is.
Okay. All right. Hey, for next week, I think I'm actually still going to be in Fresno on the 27th. Ooh. We might have to push it out to the morning of the 28th, if that could work for you.
It may even have to go out to the 29th. I'm not. My plans are a little vague. I'm going to my parents for Christmas, and then I'm coming home sometime after that.
Uh-oh. Well, we're going to have to talk about that because the 28th is show night, so we'll have to figure that out. I'd hate to be late.
I think I'm coming home on the Saturday.
Okay.
And even if I come home on the Sunday, with the time differences, it'll still work.
Okay.
But we're going to just have to be a little flexible in how we decide when. I'm going to be in internet badlands while I'm away.
I hate it. My parents,
I know. You hate it. Think how much I hate it.
It's all about me, Bart.
Yeah, well, even there isn't even proper cell phone signal, so I can't even use the iPhone to get online.
Oh, that's tragic. That's just horrible.
It really is. Because I have a 3G card for the laptop and I have a cell phone, and neither of them get me internet.
Oh, not even the cell phone card works. That's horrible.
Although I do have an actual, God bless it, a little 56K modem for the MacBook Pro.
So desperate times, right?
Oh, desperate times, but that ain't going to work for Skype.
No, I don't think that would quite work for us. But all right, well, I do have to make sure I get a show out because I did a recording for Tim Verporten, and at the very end of it, Tim is going to take a week off. And I left it at the very end of my recording. I said goodbye to Tim, and then I said, okay, to everybody else, I'm not taking a week off over at NoSilicast, so come on over here. We'll be having a party while he's over there drinking his eggnog, so I better have a show out.
Oh, that'll be so funny. So I should probably end by wishing everyone the very best for the festive season, whichever holiday you celebrate or not, or if you just get some time off work, which is also good.
Up to and including Festivus?
Hmm?
Up to and including Festivus?
Festivists?
Oh, you haven't heard of Festivus?
This is new.
I'll have to send you a link to that. It's from Seinfeld. It's an imaginary holiday from Seinfeld.
Uh-huh. For those people who believe in holidays for the sake of holidays or something?
Well, actually, I'm sure it's probably in Wikipedia. We could probably put a link in the show notes.
Okay, I'll have to dig that up. And hopefully we'll get to talk before the new year so I can wish people a happy new year next time.
All right, Bart, you have a great holiday yourself.
Same to yourself, and happy computing, of course, as well as all the other happy stuff.
Well, it looks like that's going to round it up for this week. But remember, I will not be taking a break from producing the show during the holidays. I'm always so bummed when podcasters take a break right when I have plenty of time to listen. I teased Tim Verporten of the Mac Review Cast about this. I did a review for his show, and at the very end, I told his listeners that while Tim's sitting back with a glass of eggnog taking a break, they should sneak over to podfeed.com because we're going to be having a party over here. Speaking of party time, check out show number 55 of the Mac Roundtable over at macroundtable.com. It's not out when I'm making this recording, but it'll be out soon. We definitely had a big old party over there. There were six of us on. We had a blast. We talked about all the fun we expect to have at Macworld, all the cool people we're going to talk to, all the neat software we're going to find out about. You know, just iPhone and iPod skins alone, you can spend a half a day on the show floor looking at those. We talked about how anal some of us are in our Christmas organization. That was not me this time. We talked about what we want for Christmas. Did I mention I need a new monitor? Anyway, and we talked about our New Year's Mac resolutions. Well, I'd love it if more of you got inspired to send in audio reviews and comments. I love to get them because it means I don't have to work as hard on producing the show. Huh? I'm no dummy here. Anyway, this was a great week for audio recording, so get your nerve up, grab that microphone, and send something in. You can also send, let's see, you can send those in to nosillacast@gmail.com, but you can also send in audio, you know, written comments and praise, even complaints if you like. I don't read them on the air, but you could send them. Anyway, and don't forget to follow me over on Twitter at twitter.com/podfeet. And if you're bored at Sunday nights at 5 p.m. GMT minus 8, head on over to ustream.tv/nosillacast and check out the live show. We have a lot of fun in the chat room, and you should come over and hear it. If you want, you can actually look for my channel on YouTube at look up NosillaCast on YouTube, and I'm posting the recordings, what I remember to, from Ustream. You don't get the chat, though, and that's really the best part. So come on over and join us next time. Thanks for listening, and stay subscribed.